Right now, I'd like to welcome Dylan Fates from Utah State University. And Dylan has had a wealth of experience in a number of different states, working primarily in the livestock, cattle marketing, management area. And my own experience with Dylan was one of these long-distance things. One of the great things about the internet was we were preparing some information for our Washington State congressional folks, and I just happened upon Dylan's website and found it exceptionally useful, and some really good information about the cattle area, including a real honesty to talk about some of the issues going on at the time. But Dylan, we're pleased you're with us today. And Dylan's going to talk with us about some livestock marketing strategies. The floor is yours, Dylan.
All right. Thanks, John. Thanks for that plug on the web page. I'll make sure and pay you later. So anyway, I appreciate the opportunity to visit with each of you today on some different livestock marketing challenges and look to see what we can do to try to improve our marketing on the livestock. So I'm going to briefly cover price risk. I know last week when Jim Robb talked, he covered that in a little more detail. I want to just highlight and quantify a couple of things on risk just to, again, kind of reemphasize how critical that is in marketing and the fact that it has increased over time and not decreased. And then I'll spend most of my presentation on cattle marketing issues. The reality is there probably are more alternatives there that we can consider, but I'll look at both dairy and hog marketing at the end, particularly on the maybe what we can do from a marketing standpoint in terms of purchasing feed, maybe more so than marketing our milk or swine. And then I'll summarize presentation after that. So going forward, Ed's already talked about using the futures not as a marketing tool in and of itself in terms of selling futures, but to use it to make grain marketing decisions in the cash market. And I like to look at it that way as well in terms of with livestock. The reality is the futures is a predictor of futures prices, and unlike the grains that showed a pretty strong trend for the futures to overpredict, in the livestock we find it to be equally wrong in terms of overpredicting some years and underpredicting some years. There's not that consistent trend as to whether it's going to be higher or lower. But what we do have is it is the best guess at the current time as to where the market may wind up at the future point in time. And so just looking at, for example, somebody with a cow-calf operation or a yearling where you're looking at the fall feeder cattle contract in the spring of the year, trying to decide how much those are going to change from year to year. So I'm going to evaluate changes in the November feeder cattle contract from the spring of the year, and I looked at that really in three different time frames, May, June and July, and didn't find much difference. So this is a 10-year analysis. What I found was the standard deviation in terms of how much prices changed from spring to fall was 9.5. That means that in one out of 3 years, prices are likely to be either $9.50 higher or lower in November than what was expected in the spring. So that's a difference of $50 per head, higher or lower on your calf. Obviously, we're not too concerned when we get that bump up from what the spring to fall was, but is there something we can do in those years to avoid when it drops $50? Now, there are other years when it's the change is much less than that, but the reality is these bigger swings seem to be occurring on a more regular basis rather than less regular. And I think Jim Robb alluded to that last week in terms of that some of the shocks to the market seem to be overwhelming the typical seasonal and cyclical patterns. Also looking at milk price variability, looked at this in a little different way, just looking at average changes, weekly changes in prices from 20 years ago and then 10 years ago and kind of the recent years. And what you see there, the number I want you to focus on down there at the bottom, the coefficient of variation, that's basically a percentage variability. And what you can see from the 90s to the 2000s, we've essentially doubled our risk in that market. As milk prices have come up, we've entered into the export market. That's good at times. That provided us those high prices, but when those exports disappear, we also then suffer those lower prices. So we just have more variability in milk prices that we need to deal with than we used to have to deal with. And then going back to the corn market, and again, and Ed has talked a lot about that, but just, again, a point out that these markets are becoming more variable, not less variable over time. When you go back into the 80s and 90s, you know, corn varied around $2.50, and it didn't vary very much around that. Well, now we have much more variability in that market. Again, you can see almost a doubling of that risk from the coefficient of variation. So there's opportunities both on the selling side of these markets to try and pick up a dime or a dollar, and there's also opportunities on the purchasing side to manage some of the costs, which particularly on the dairy, we may have more opportunities to manage cost in some years than managing our output price. So what can you do? Before I hit this, let me just point out and highlight again what I mean by some of the shocks are becoming are overwhelming our traditional seasonal and cyclical patterns. And if we just think about some of the recent shocks to the market, we had our financial crisis, of course, from a year ago. That collapsed most of the commodity markets. Part of that was because of a loss of the export markets because of the world financial crisis. Our exchange rates changed, and so we had a big drop in the commodities across the board. The swine industry is well aware of what happened when the H1N1 flu virus got dubbed the swine flu, and of course the misconception out there that eating swine could contribute to that, and so they have their market dropping counter-cyclically and seasonally because of an event that certainly no one can plan for. If we think of sometimes government policy changes, mandated growth in biofuels, how that changed the grain markets. We take bovine spongiform and softlitis, BSE, or mad cow, it was commonly known. The changes, both positive and negative for the U.S. markets, positive initially when that was in Canada, and then negative when it hit the U.S. So these are things that we can't forecast well, we can't plan for, but if we are forward-looking, planning, there are times when we can be in the right position, regardless of some of those shocks that hit the system. So what I'm suggesting is that you sharpen your pencil, you evaluate your alternatives, both your selling alternatives and your feed cost alternatives. And so I'm going to spend most of the rest of my time kind of outlining some of these alternatives you might consider, and maybe as much as anything just providing the framework for analyzing that rather than analyzing it in any particular given situation. So I'll start with cattle. Again, highlight this thing that the short-term variability and the need to evaluate these alternatives each time you're thinking about entering into them is maybe more important than knowing historically where we're at in some long-term cyclical pattern. So the first thing I'll look at is preconditioning of cattle. This is kind of a short term where we're keeping the cattle somewhere 30 to probably 60 days post weaning, And for most preconditioning programs, it involves giving a set of vaccinations on the calves, and it also involves getting them used to coming to feed so that when they're shipped to a feedlot, they're prepared to go right on feed. Iowa State University did a study a couple of years ago where they looked at sale prices in auction markets. They found a $6.15 per hundredweight premium on third-party certified programs. That is about a $30 bump in the value of a 500-pound calf. If it was just the rancher's claim but no third-party certification, still a $3 per hundredweight premium if you could document that the calves have been weaned for 45 days, gained some weight. Oklahoma State, in a little older study off of the Superior Livestock Auction video auction, they found a $4 per hundredweight premium to those calves that were in the, quote, VAC 45 program, again, a specific type of preconditioning program following a set protocol on vaccinations. And just if the calves had received some prior vaccinations, about a $1.10 premium. So it looks like there's a premium in the marketplace, but there's also a cost to these programs. If you're weaning and vaccinating your calves, you're going to have some costs, and then you're probably going to have some feed. So here's just an example program that you might consider of putting the calves back out on maybe the meadow for 15 days, supplementing with a little hay, getting used to them to eating hay, then bringing them into a dry lot for 30 days on kind of an alfalfa grass mixture with some concentrate added. And again, there's various pre-mix supplements that you can buy instead of the corn, or you can change this ration up. What we're trying to do is get the calves so that they're used to eating grass or eating hay and grain, coming to water, and that they're ready to go for a feedlot. Following this type of program, if you assume a 500-pound calf and basically a dollar sale weight, looking at that, I'm budgeting, saying in here, $40 to $50 cost for those programs. What you can see is that if you don't get a premium in your market, then the preconditioning is about a break even with just selling at weaning. But if you can get that premium in the market, and I used a $4 per hundredweight premium, then it appears that there's another $20 to $30 per head profit by putting these cattle into a preconditioning program. So just something to consider, and I suspect that the big variability here will not be as much on the $4 premium, but more on what your cost of your preconditioning program might be. So that's where producers need to get out the sharp pencil, evaluate their program. Another one would just be an on-ranch retained ownership program where we're going to keep the cattle around longer. And I'll look at kind of four different programs here. One would just be a little longer extended on preconditioning type program, very similar ration. We could also go with more of the traditional background program, about 100 days, a little heavier rate of gain. This is fairly popular in the Midwest where they have access to corn silage. I use alfalfa hay and corn, but a silage-based program equally effectively on that. And then we can look at longer on-ranch where you're keeping the calves clear through the winter on grass and either selling in the spring to hit that grass market, which sometimes has a seasonal peak in it, and that depends a lot on the regional markets, or if you have adequate grass on your own place to keep them to a long yearling and basically sell them in the fall, 900 to 1,000 pound yearling at that point in time. So looking at that, this slide, not sure how well it shows up on your screen, but just showing the variability of those returns over time, the program that the way I put it together with the alfalfa hay and corn that did the poorest was the backgrounding program, fairly consistent loser, if you will. If you have access to silage or cheaper feed sources where you can get that kind of gain, then that program can pay out. The 60-day program, about a break even. Again, this one doesn't assume the preconditioning premium, so if you threw that in there, that's where you get the 20 to 30 head premium. And then you can see the green bars, the light green is for the selling in the spring, the long green is in the summer. If you have the opportunity, you have the resources to go to a grass program, the market has been paying for that most years, and you can see there's only one year there really with a large loss occurring. Again, this is a program where, you know, I think it's a good risk management program, because rather than one time frame that you can sell the cattle, you actually have multiple times. If drought hits, you can pull those yearlings off early, and then you still have the resources for your cow herd rather than have to call the cow herd. So I'm somewhat of a proponent of that if you're in an area where you have good grass resources to graze those cattle. Sometimes we look at programs and we look at ranch resources and we don't really have the ability, whether that's management ability or resource ability, to keep the cattle on farm, but we want to maintain ownership. And so I looked at, evaluated a couple of off-farm retained ownership programs as well. Looked at wheat pasture program. This is, you know, there's different wheat pastures, short day, long day. I just picked one to kind of look at, a typical November to March time frame, couple pounds average daily gain. With the wheat pasture cost currently around $135 a head, depending upon where you are. I threw in a $20 per head transportation cost, and so that program's costing about $155. Compare that to a corn stock grazing program, about the same length of time, 120 day, November to March. Not quite the gain on that program, pound and a half. Corn stocks around $30 per head per day. Little supplement to go with that. Lots of corn stock grazers will supplement with some of the distiller's grain. And then you have some other costs add up to $40, so your total cost in coon transportation around $120 per head. And then lastly, looked at putting the cattle directly into a feedlot. This hasn't been very profitable the last couple of years, but certainly if you look over time, there's been some opportunities for return in here. But certainly, as grain prices increase, we'll have higher total costs in this program, getting up around the $450 to $500 per head in added cost. So you're about doubling your cost from the value of that calf till you sell it. Well, just looking at those programs over the last 20 years, again, you can see the variability there. If you're having a hard time reading the graphic, the blue bars represent wheat pastures, green are the corn stalks, and the reddish or brown bars are the feedlot. Feedlot probably a little more variable, a little more risky than either of those other two in terms of you get some extreme returns and some very significant losses as well. The corn stalks and the wheat pastures, both of those, the market risk tends to be less. What we tend to face there, and it's not built into these slides, is the production risk. If it doesn't rain on the wheat pastures, those dry up. If you're out on corn stalks and you get a severe winter blizzard, you can have some significant additional feeding costs, or sometimes again be forced to pull off that. So the risk on those programs are more production, less marketing. One other program to consider, call cow feeding. This one actually does have a fairly consistent seasonal pattern and a consistent change from our thinner cows to our more fleshy cows that you can exploit through a feeding program, so that if you're traditionally selling cattle in November, calling and selling then, as comparing to feeding them into the February, March time frame when you see that seasonal increase in price, and adding more flesh and getting another 10 to 15% increase in the price to grade change, there's some opportunities on this program. The other thing that I looked at is how variable this program has been over time relative to the yearling program. The cold cow feeding, much less risky than the yearling feeding program. And in fact, as we've gotten grain prices back down, again, this is a program that I would look at with a sharp pencil. And I think if you have limited feeding opportunities, you may be money ahead to sell your calves and feed your cull cows rather than feeding the calves. Well, retained ownership is not always the answer. Just because we're in a time period of low calf prices doesn't mean you should retain. You need to evaluate each of those alternatives. As the picture illustrates there, sometimes leaving one tractor stuck is better than getting three or four mired in the muck. So don't make your decision to retain simply because of prices are lower than you would like. Evaluate those decisions carefully before moving on. Let me hit just briefly dairy and then the hog industry a little bit. Certainly the dairy industry is in a critical situation. Dairies have been losing money. The markets are offering some hope as we look towards 2010, but depending upon individual dairy situation, that hope is maybe only getting to break even at best. Experts I hear say we probably still need to remove at least 100,000 cows from the national dairy herd to get the supply back in line with where we're at. Part of the challenge for the dairy industry, they build up their herd based on expectation of exports continuing, and with those falling off, really in a challenging situation right now. A lot of times there's not much you can do in the short term on managing your milk price risk in terms of you can go into the futures or options market, but in terms of altering a milking schedule or altering the processor you're going with, those are decisions that are long-term decisions and not short-term in that. But we can do some things on the our feed cost containment. Certainly, I think in most areas of the country, hay costs are going to be cheaper this year than what they've been the last 2 years. And there's also probably some opportunities to lock in corn. You just saw Ed show that if he were selling corn, he probably would not be selling most of it at harvest. Well, if you're buying corn, maybe that's the smart time to be buying it or contracting at that time, as then the markets are moving higher. So I just suggest that you look at those grain purchasing decisions carefully in this year. Certainly, this is probably a year when it may be a good time to lock in those feed prices at or near harvest as much as possible. And whether you do that through the use of the futures or some type of forward contract, whatever works best for you to get those supplies tied up when prices may be as low as we've seen them for some time and may not see them that low again. Other alternative, just to plug on the dairy a little bit, the USDA Risk Management Agency has introduced an insurance product, Livestock Gross Margin, that basically tries to lock in a minimum price for milk and a maximum price for feed costs. That may be attractive to some of you. It would be similar to buying a put option on the milk and buying a call option on your corn and soybean meal. Unfortunately, with many of the crop insurance products, there is some subsidy in that. With this LGM for dairy, there is not. And so going back to kind of what Ed said earlier, over time, you're probably paying for insurance that you're not using, but certainly in some short-term situation scenarios, that may be worth looking into. The yellow states there are the states that that program is available. If you're located in one of the gray states, that program's not available for you at this time. A couple things on hog marketing and cost control. A lot of the same ideas here as with the dairy may have more ability to impact profit by dealing on the cost control side than on the marketing side. Our pigs are not as flexible as cattle in terms of whether we're going to sell them at different ages or stages. It's pretty much you're either in the feeder pig business or you're in the slaughter hog business, and there's not a lot of trade-offs in going back and forth between those. current situation, not very profitable. The futures market, again, are signaling higher prices in 2010. We're also looking at much lower feed costs for this fall and into winter than what we were a year ago. That kind of is offering good news and bad news to the market. The good news is it looks like profitability should return. The bad news is it looks like profitability should return. And so we have producers hanging on to sows rather than culling them with the expectation of future profitability. If we don't liquidate enough sows, then it's likely that those futures markets that are signaling higher prices will deteriorate in those prices, and they'll come back down towards current cash rather than current cash going up. So there's some concern out there that the signal to increase profitability may be actually delaying what needs to happen in terms of getting a few more sows slaughtered to, again, bring that production back in line with the current domestic demand and current export market. The hog market is another one that is suffering right now because of a loss of exports in these difficult financial times. Managing feed costs, again, I point out that corn market right now and going into harvest may be a very good opportunity to lock in some corn. As you noted, there's not as much carry in the soybean grain prices. I'm not for sure on the meal prices. I don't follow that market real close. But again, look for those opportunities when those prices dip to try to tie up some of those supplies of grain and concentrates ahead of time rather than just pricing on the market. How long will these lower grain prices last? One of the challenges I think facing all the livestock industries will be as the economy strengthens, that will probably bring up their output prices, maybe even enhance their export markets, but at the same time, it will probably also raise grain prices as well. And so I'm not for sure that you'll see that much relief in terms of profit opportunities on that. So I guess what I'm saying is I think there's some opportunities right now to lock in your feed that may do more for protecting your or enhancing your profit than dealing with the output side of the market. Just to summarize, I don't think there's any silver bullet out there. Nothing is easy in these markets, and so I didn't present any one thing that should make you money, but I think, again, you need to be proactive. You need to carefully evaluate each marketing alternative. Take the opportunities when they're there to lock in cheaper feeds. Look for the futures and options, not only as it may be a guide for evaluating some of those, but when they do exist, when there are opportunities that you can lock in something above your cost of production, do so. Same way with the insurance programs. I didn't talk about the LRP for feeder cattle, fed cattle, or swine, but that's one, again, to kind of set a minimum price, insure for a minimum price in there. Just, again, as part of those, trying to look at those alternatives, those are some additional tools that are out there that producers can evaluate as the insurance alternatives in addition to the traditional futures and market alternatives. I think that concludes my presentation, John, so I'll throw it back to you.
Dylan, thank you. Excellent presentation. We do have some questions in from the audience, and one of them has to do with improved herd genetics. And the question is, do you have any data that shows the returns on how improved herd genetics can impact the returns of producer gains when retaining ownership off the ranch?
Yes, I do have that data. This is the disadvantage of being distance versus me speaking locally. I could quick pull up on my computer some slides that show that. Certainly, the variability in returns, and particularly in the feedlot, I have that data, are as great within any given market time frame between producers and cattle as they are over markets. We routinely we routinely see differences of over $100 per head from the high-end profits to the low-end. And so if you have selected those genetics for improved growth, you've selected those genetics where you know that you're going to be grading a higher percentage choice, then you can expect a greater return than somebody who doesn't have those genetics. And I guess what I've seen is that if you have a history, whether you've fed some of your cattle out or you've gotten that data back and know those returns, those are fairly repeatable. Weather impacts gain and quality grade some, but routinely those cattle with better genetics will outperform those cattle that don't have those genetics in them. So certainly, if you're going to retain ownership, it's great if you have some of that data or can get some of that data and know how your cattle perform.
You, one of your slides, and we're going to go with some polling questions here while I ask another question. And Ed, if you can turn your mic back on, I'll have another question or two here for you.
I'm here.
Dylan, good. Okay, Dylan, Jim Robb also pointed at the need to reduce the dairy's number of cows to bring production down into some balance with demand, and you've identified that as well. What impact is that happens one way or the other? What's the rollover impact into both cattle and hog markets?
Probably not a great deal of rollover in the hog market. It would kind of be a secondary or even a third stage impact, if you will, but the dairy producers have their CWT program, which is self-funded, where they've been trying to take cattle out of the markets. Up till now, I've said that's had fairly minimal impact on the cattle industry because most of those callings took place through the summer when we don't call that many of our beef cow herd. As we're entering this stage of the year now, and there's actually another round of the CWT cattle that are going to market now, and talk of another sign-up period, that'll not only impact the value of those dairy calls being sold, but it'll impact the value of our beef call market. And so as we see increased calling taking place this fall, I'm guessing in lots of markets we'll drop below the $40 per hundredweight price on cull cows. We'll be in the upper 30s, which will be significantly lower than we've been for some time. As we go forward, it's not adding that much. Well, it adds tonnage, but it's not all that much tonnage. It's more, and it's most of that is going into the hamburger market, which actually, in the present time frame, that's the market that's held up the best on the beef end. Beef prices are lower because we've lost our upper end markets, the restaurant trade. That's where consumers have turned away. They're still eating beef, just the lower end cut. So in a sense, we're supplying more of the lower end beef to meet what consumers are actually buying. That's the positive. That's why I think that there's really will be less trade-off or less impact on the price of hogs, but certainly as we put a little more beef out there in the hamburger market, if those prices are lowered, then that'll have some impact on the hog market, but that'll be pretty small impact.